Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the TF Podcast, where we talk tech, finance, and that usually revolves around Bitcoin, crypto, and blockchain. I'm excited for my next guest to introduce you all to him. His name is Neil Berquist. He is the founder and CEO of CoinMe. They do Bitcoin ATMs, and they also have a private client services business. I've had the pleasure of knowing Neil for a few years now, actually. He's been part of our conferences in the past, and we've had him speak. And so I'm excited to have him here on the podcast. So Neil, welcome, and love if you could introduce yourself, please.
Yeah, great to be here. Thank you, Jonathan, for the opportunity. Neil Berquist, co-founder and CEO of CoinMe. CoinMe was started about 6 years ago and really launched the first licensed Bitcoin ATM in the United States. And the business has evolved there to realize that having a cash on-ramp to the crypto economy is extremely important. So really focused on enabling crypto payments and remittances with a cash on-ramp. And so scaled the company up to be able to crypto enable any kiosk ATM or point of sale device to power the largest cash on-ramp in the United States.
That's awesome. We all have everybody that's probably listening to this or into Bitcoin has probably seen one of your ATMs, or at least they've seen a Bitcoin ATM. I'm curious, like, where the thought behind a Bitcoin ATM first came about for you, right? Like, because, prior to that, you think about Bitcoin as being this very much this digital thing, and like, you have a digital relationship with it, but there probably wasn't very many fiat on-ramps, for people holding cash. So I'd love if you could kind of just touch on how that came about.
Certainly. I mean, actually, the idea was this would just be a little side project, let's just deploy some ATMs and maybe we'll go there once a week and service them and just make some, monthly revenue off of them. That obviously hasn't come true. but my co-founder actually just bought 3 Bitcoin ATMs, pretty much sight unseen, after the world's first ATM opened up in Vancouver, Canada. And that was back during the hype of 2013, going into October, November, when Bitcoin went from $100 to $1,000 and the machine paid itself off in like the second week. So my goal was like, this is a good business. I'm going to buy 3 of these. And then, I was talking with him he didn't really have an idea of, where to put them or whether it was legal or not. And, pretty much everything involved with the business operation side of it. So I was in a tech incubator and I was like, well, we need one of those here. If we're going to be a true tech incubator and be part of what's next. So started diving into it, realized, okay, this is money. You can't pretend to be like Uber, Airbnb, where you just move fast and break things. Went down to Department of Financial Institutions, educated them about it, the technology, why we need to protect the consumer, and ended up getting a license for it. And we built a company around it and subsequently launched the first licensed Bitcoin ATM, May 1st, 2014. And, it was an experiment. Who's going to use it? Why are they going to use it? Why are we talking about cash? Why are we even talking about an ATM in the 21st century? And there was a few advantages. Back then, trust was at an all-time low. You had Silk Road and Mt. Gox. And so a lot of people that heard of Bitcoin were just like, I'm not touching that at all. But when you have a physical representation of this, magic internet money, you create trust. And so many of our customers were first-time purchasers. An ATM. Well, I know if I put cash in this machine that I'm going to get Bitcoin because, if I don't, I'm going to steal their machine. And so being able to have that touch point, have that familiar experience, and also realizing that cash is alive and well. There's $3 trillion of US paper currency in circulation. And if you look at particular use cases like remittance, you see markets like US to Mexico, where the majority of that's done or originates as cash. Mm-hmm. Having a cash portal where you can turn that into digital cash and then send it anywhere there's a smartphone in the world, 2.5 billion smartphones, that's a pretty interesting use case.
Totally.
And it also allows for instant fulfillment. If you go to Coinbase and buy Bitcoin, there's chargebacks and fraud. So you can't necessarily move that Bitcoin out of Coinbase immediately. Whereas if you put cash into CoinMe, we give you your Bitcoin instantly. So then you can do what you want with it.
Yeah, that's excellent. That's excellent. And I know because you were talking about like the regulatory side of it, and DFI, the Department of Financial Institutions, they even like use you guys often as an example of how to do it the right way, right? So like, you guys have done the right thing for quite a while. So that's good.
Yeah, and kudos to them. I don't know about you, but I always had a mindset like regulators just kind of get in the way.
Yeah.
But this was a unique situation where like they actually partnered on innovation.
Yeah.
And they saw the impact of that. And actually, I will say, because we worked with them and were able to get a license and launch, we were able to provide access to digital currency for the Washington state market at that time, you know, at a time where most people didn't have access.
Totally.
And, you know, Bitcoin went down to $250 and, you know, then came back up. We added up all the purchases and the price at which they bought at, and with an average sell price, you know, lower than what the price is now. You know, those customers just on their cash transactions in Washington state made over $20 million just on the gain of Bitcoin because they simply had access. Wow. So, you know, kudos to the regulator for jumping on it and enabling the citizens of Washington to prosper.
Yeah, definitely. That's awesome. Yeah. So, you know, I'd love to just jump into, you know, kind of what's happening in the world real quick too. You know, for those listening, I don't know if you're aware, but there's a pandemic going on. Just kidding. But like, you know, if things are different than they were first month of 2020, right? And so, you know, I'm curious how business is operating right now. Like, are you seeing, like, are things slowing down because people don't want to go out? Or is it the opposite in the sense that, hey, we're thinking about, you know, we need more sovereignty. I just kind of love to understand that.
Yeah. So, I mean, from the founding 6 years ago, we've evolved a bit. Essentially, we shut down our own machines. So we don't no longer have our own ATMs, thank goodness. And we purely are a software play. So we crypto enable Coinstar kiosks. So we're a software integration with those kiosks. We're live on 3,500 kiosks in 27 states. And then we also run the private client trading desk, which is essentially buying via Bankwire ACH. And then we have a wallet. So because of those three products, we've been able to work remotely with no operational impact. The Coinstar kiosks are in grocery stores, which is probably the best retail location to be in during a global pandemic.
Right.
And so the grocery stores are deemed essential. Coinstar has been deemed essential. And so we've been able to operate and continue to deploy cash logistics and field service workers to be able to keep those kiosks online. But we've seen kind of a similar trend to what you see in the grocery store. People are going to the grocery store less, but they're buying a lot more. And so we're seeing our average transactions amounts skyrocket, and transaction counts from existing customers is relatively flat, but we have also a lot of new customers. So, you know, net positive, we've been growing about 20% month over month.
Oh, wow.
Since January. So it's been positive, but I think it's just what's really awesome, and I think most people listening would agree with this, is that now, you know, the value of money is a national conversation.
Yeah.
And, you know, we used to have these like fringe meetups where people are like, oh, the central bank, you know, printing money. You know, do you realize that the dollar is not going to be worth what it is, you know, next year as it is now? And, you know, that 60% of people don't even own stocks. And so quantitative easing, it doesn't actually just perpetuates inequality. And now people are, you know, talking about that.
Totally.
And yeah, aware of that. So it's driving demand.
You're totally right. You hear, I hear people that I guess, you know, people I'm contacts with or, you know, on social media and like people that I guess I wouldn't think of being the type to vocalize those types of concerns or say things about that. And it's like, all this quantitative easing. I'm like, whoa, I didn't even know like that was something you were concerned about, but so in
like
your
7-year-old nephew, you know, you just wouldn't expect it.
Right. Yeah. It's, you know, some people have been posting today that the $1,200 stimulus is now worth $1,670 or whatever. Cause like they ended up buying Bitcoin with it. Right.
So yeah, we have seen more $1,200 transactions, come through, but it's been good from that perspective. But, you know, it's you know, I was sharing with you earlier, but I think Satya Nadella, CEO of Microsoft, said it best, you know, 2 years of digital transformation in 2 months, you know, all these things that we've seen from more of a vision perspective are happening now, and they're happening faster than ever before.
It's so true. And though, you know, you see the companies that are, you know, taking it on and accepting it, and they're the ones that are excelling. And then you see some of these other companies that are more like, well, when things go back to normal, or, you know, kind of just preparing to go back to this old paradigm. And it's like, wow, I think we'll be able to see what companies, and this is outside of crypto, just in general, like what companies will be able to thrive and whatnot. And it's, yeah, it's just evolving like to the new dynamic. So
yeah, so, world's changing very fast.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, when you think about what's happening right now with, from a, and I don't know if you can speak to this as a CEO, but maybe you tell me, but when you think about what's happening with Bitcoin overall, so, you know, Bitcoin went down in March and went from like in the 10,000 range to like 5,000. And now it's been slowly setting. We're seeing like a little bit of decoupling from the stock market, right? Like how Bitcoin is continuing to go up. Like, what are your things like based off like kind of your knowledge and that you're seeing that you think attribute to that? Like, is it that, are we getting more of an awareness overall? Is this kind of like where Bitcoin shines and shows because of this situation? I'd love your thoughts on that.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a few things going on. I mean, one, you had the initial panic, which pretty much you know, large asset managers sell everything and just go to cash, right? Yeah. I just want cash. I want to wait and see what's going to happen. And you know, that included a lot of big money that owned Bitcoin, right? I just want to hold cash. And then you kind of hit that bottom or that lull. You know, we'll see if it's the lull, you know, from a public equities perspective. But and then it's a redeployment, and it's like, okay, who's going to win in this? And I think with the halving event, couldn't have been timed any better. Because if you had any doubt, you know, the fact that the supply is going to be reduced here in the short run, and it also creates a lot of media opportunity for it to get in the public discussion,
yeah,
which only increases awareness and then acquisition and conversion. So those are great events. So when you look at redeploying, you know, we're seeing a lot more kind of traditional money or first-time purchasers coming into Bitcoin because people are looking for a deflationary asset. You know, we're printing more money, and you know, ironically, at the same time, Bitcoin's reducing its supply by 50%. And so, you know, we see a lot of people that aren't necessarily, you know, putting all their money into Bitcoin, you know, but you know, at least to having it be a portion of their portfolio, you know.
Yeah.
And so, if you're stocking up at the grocery store on other essentials, well, you know, Bitcoin's essential too.
Yeah.
And we see that happen. So, you know, overall, you know, I'm fairly bullish, you know, from a holding perspective. But we also see people that aren't only just getting exposure to it as a store of value, but are also using it as a medium of exchange, which is really interesting to see. So as the pandemic starts really taking impact on in developing countries, you know, there's a lot of need. Mm-hmm. And so we see a lot of kind of those flows to those areas of need in the form of Bitcoin. And then actually it being used as a form of payments. And so it's pretty interesting to see those types of use cases. I would say those are like super like early adopters, and you know, it's sure. Definitely not like a mainstream use case right now. But you know, it does enable a roadmap where you can then provide a better user experience where people might be sending money or doing payments using crypto and the interoperability of different blockchains and not even know it. And,
yeah.
And you know, that's really the future of where things are going as you look at kind of these use cases around cryptocurrencies and everyday payments.
Yeah, for sure. Exactly. It's you know, just like with your, when you run a credit card, like you don't care about all the tech behind it. You just care that you're able to make that payment, you know, overall.
Yeah.
You know, touching on that, can you kind of walk through us through your private client? You know, you don't see too many companies that are doing that. And so is that, I guess, exactly what it sounds like? Is that kind of like a financial advisor for buying Bitcoin?
Yeah, it's a Bitcoin advisor. It's someone that you can call, someone yeah. you can text. And so with that in mind, you get a lot of people, you know, maybe who value that trust and value mm-hmm. that human connection and have a lot of misperceptions around Bitcoin or digital currency in general. And so they can just ask them, you know, in a safe place and have a friendly person that you can talk to who's more than happy to stay on the phone with you and answer all those kind of one-on-one questions that you may have, you know, custody or purchasing or pricing or, you know, just get an opinion on educational content and things like that. So it's been a nice little business, and it's more of a mission business for us because, mm-hmm. you know, we have a mission around access. And in order, you can provide access, but in order for people to actually take advantage of the access and utilize it, you need understanding. And yeah. So providing that knowledge and that understanding is something that we take on and do that through the private client group. So they'll go to meetups and speak or do webinars and
sure.
really just help build literacy for digital currency as an investment class.
Totally.
Or at least as an asset that people can take a position in and have a safe hand to make the leap into crypto.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's super smart for a lot of reasons, but also because, you know, I've just kind of always said that I really think that banks one day will be selling Bitcoin, right? It just like, because of the margin opportunity, that's the only reason, right? Not because of some need for decentralization or, you know, like democratizing money or any of that. It's just like literally just on that side. And so, you know, it seems like you're really taking advantage of an interesting opportunity there. Is like kind of like to be first there. So I like that you guys are doing that overall. You know, with that is, you know, I'd love to just get also your understanding of just, you know, what are your thoughts on how banks think about cryptocurrency, how banks think about Bitcoin? My guess is you've put a lot of thought into that. And I bet you've probably spoken to quite a few banks in that regard as well.
Hundreds.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, when an investor asks me, you know, what's one of your biggest risks, you know, or one of your biggest challenges, you know, it's finding a bank to partner with for scale, not only domestically, but internationally. You know, it's mm-hmm. a bit of a black box. You know, the large banks don't want to touch it.
And when you're Sorry. Saying that, you mean like from you being a bank client for like deposits and things like that, or?
Yeah, really, really two functions. One, where we can just make deposits and pay operating expenses. And then the second one is to be able to do a funds flow through. Mm-hmm. So that would be like depositing customers' money, wiring it to liquidity sources, filling orders. And so that would be an MSB account. And then just the operating account, you know, just deposit our revenue and make payroll. Is equally as challenging. But it's a risk perspective. And it's also a lot of misperceptions. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we're extremely strong in compliance. That's where we've invested most of our money into, is to ensure that we have a bulletproof KYC and AML program. We do a third party AML audit every year and have passed every one. We are going through an IT audit. These are all requirements of a licensee. You know, in the early stages, they can be frustrating because they're so expensive. But you know, they're important long term, and they become strengths and pillars. And so when we talk to banks, we really lead with that and mm-hmm. really help them understand like our controls and protections that really make this a very actually low risk product for them to bank and support. And so it's really just an educational piece. But you know, at the end of the day, you know, like if you were to ask a random room, you know, who are some of the most conservative people in the world, you know, bankers. And so now we're trying to get them to support this new money, you know, that's decentralized. And so that's a challenge. But, you know, fortunately, we've been able to find a few partners that have enabled the operation. And, you know, we'll continue to grow. And, you know, we'll see what happens with some of the larger banks, you know, whether they will dip their toes in.
Yeah. And from what you're seeing that, you know, you just mentioned that the larger banks, is it usually, you know, being able to operate with some smaller banks because they need to have some leverage, a level of differentiation, like, as opposed to like a larger bank who might say like, oh, that this doesn't fit the risk profile or the gain's not positive enough?
I mean, it's kind of simple. Like the once you're over $10 billion in assets, there's a lot more controls and restrictions of what you can do. So if a bank's below $10 billion, you know, they can generally do more. The second piece is, you know, just the general rule that, you know, the bigger you are, the lower risk you take. And so you could have one customer out of a million. And if you screw up with that one customer, you can sink the ship.
Yeah.
Or at least, you know, put a pretty big hole on the side. So it's just not worth it, you know, if you're a large bank to get involved, unless you're making just insane amount of fees. But if you're below 10 billion, then there's a pool of banks that will dive in and actually understand the business case for it and, you know, create the controls and be more willing to work with you. So, you know, and I think we can all agree that a lot of innovation happens in kind of those smaller, medium-sized organizations that are more agile and able to move quickly and not have the bureaucracy slow them down or kill things early. So that's where we're seeing in the banking sector.
Yeah. are there opportunities, I guess without going to like down your roadmap or anything like that, but are there opportunities for CoinMe or, you know, for crypto banks? Like, do you see that?
Yeah,
I know there's companies that are doing that, like with Wyoming, you know, in Wyoming, right? But like, yeah, I guess I'm sure you probably thought quite a bit about this. What are your thoughts overall there?
Yeah, I mean, I do think there's an opportunity for that. You know, I think Silvergate has proven out the model to an extent. I think, you know, Metropolitan Commercial Bank has created a pretty strong book of business in this space. I think there's a few others that are really starting to see this area grow. I think what would be interesting is if we'd ever get to like a Bitcoin backed bank, you know, that would be, you know, truly game changing. But you know, you got to talk to the OCC and see if that would ever.
Yeah. And let's dig into that. Why do you think that would be so game changing?
Well, I mean, you look at the crypto market today, everything moves with Bitcoin. And so what if, like, you know, you had cold wallets of Bitcoin in a bank, and then customers, you know, had a representation of it. And then you do lending based on it, and you do all your financial products, you know, based on the Bitcoin reserves that the bank has. You know, the concern would be the volatility, but maybe you could offset that, you know, with some options in the future. So, you know, it would be interesting to see if something like that could come to fruition. I think, you know, even before that would happen, most likely there's going to be a bank that offers a stable coin.
Right. Yeah,
that's probably the most obvious thing that would come to market. But, you know, that just triggers so many kind of legacy laws that have to get addressed. Like, does everyone who owned that stable coin have to do KYC, or can there be a secondary market for it? Or can that stable coin, does it have to be tied to the dollar? Can it be tied to the dollar plus some form of interest? You know, it creates some interesting questions, but yeah, that's why lawyers stay in business. You know, so entrepreneurs figure out how to answer these questions.
Yeah, exactly. Entrepreneurs can come up with the ideas, and then but you know, we are definitely seeing that, right? There's some article a few months back that was saying something like 10% of banks are thinking about stable currencies, you know, in crypto, a stable crypto, you know, seriously, right? And then, you know, we have JP Morgan Chase with their stable coin, essentially, and then. You know, even the U.S. government has been talking about some level of digital dollar, right? So, you know, what do you think that takes? And you know, what are your thoughts in the regards to stable currencies like versus Bitcoin? And then, you know, I'll kind of say what I think too on that. But, you know, like, for example, a lot of people might not like the idea of a digital currency because of the fact that it wouldn't be decentralized and all these sort of things. But like, my opinion is like, it's not created to be decentralized, right? It's created to be just a tool within that banking system. So
yeah, and one of the questions also about, as we see crypto go more mainstream, is are people gonna, how important is decentralization to the everyday consumer? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we've kind of learned, unfortunately, well, in some cases privacy is not as important as you think it would be. You know, people don't take the time to read privacy policies to really protect their own data and identity. They're happier to have a free business model and sacrifice their privacy in return for that. But we're seeing some pushback on that. And so are we going to see something similar in crypto? Are people going to be educated enough to really know, okay, well, this is a centralized coin, therefore subject to manipulation. And, you know, maybe the trust isn't what I thought it would be. I really want decentralization. You know, we'll see what happens there. But, you know, currency is supposed to be subject to inflation, because the goal from an economist's perspective is for people to spend it. And so you don't want people to just hoard cash and not spend it. And it's, you know, from an investor's perspective, that's have it be a part of your portfolio, but don't have it be your portfolio. Whereas, you know, Bitcoin, on the other hand, is deflationary. And so it's really not, from an economics perspective, designed to be a currency in that way. And so because it's, you know, it's more likely to increase in value. And so people are really seeing that more as like the gold, you know, store of value. I'm just going to buy it and sit on it. Mm-hmm. But that's where the stable coins could come in to serve more as like the currency card as it relates to payments and spending, because, you know, you're not just buying it as an investment, you're buying it as a medium of exchange. And if that's done properly, you know, it's more efficient. You know, it can be borderless, it can be mobile first. And so there's a lot of advantages around, you know, focus on the medium of exchange use case around stable coins.
Yeah, I definitely agree. From a business context, it makes a lot of sense, right? It's like if you need to be transferring funds between individuals or within your banking network, or also like even with retailers and brands, like I think we definitely see a world sometime where they have their own stable currency or some level of that, and just again, it's more from like the business value to it than anything of that in-network currency or in-network transactions. What I always say is, like, while I'm a fan of that and I like that, it's also one of the reasons why I continue to be bullish and be an even bigger fan of Bitcoin, is because of the fact that it's the opposite of that. It is more of the being in control of your, not more of it is being in control of your finances, being sovereign in that regard.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I definitely think that Bitcoin will always be Bitcoin. Yeah. It's going to be its own beast, and will always be majority of the market in that sense. So that's why you see a lot of better than gold and things like that. So it'll be interesting to watch. There's a lot of examples of how, like in developing countries where the banking infrastructure is crap. The local currency is, who knows, right? Hyperinflation and, isn't trusted. And so you look at those types of countries, I'm really excited to see what they actually adopt and what really crosses the chasm. Is it Bitcoin as a store of value in medium of exchange? Is it Bitcoin plus a handful of other kind of cryptos? I think that's really fascinating to track that. So I'm really excited to see what happens next there over the next 5 years.
Totally. I definitely agree with that. As you kind of go about thinking with where we're at, you're mentioning this a little bit ago about, we're the combination of this destabilization, I guess, of currency and printing of money, and now we're going towards the halving. This is what, your third halving or your second halving for you?
Third.
Yeah. So like, what have you seen? Like what's been different, this time around for you? Obviously you have a company that you're running that's at a bigger stage, but like what's the main difference, I guess you would say, but behind then and now for you?
I think during the last halving event, it was very obvious that it was just gonna go. I was texting and my family members, like even 6 months in advance of it. It was just so obvious. I tried to get a loan for like $5 million so they could buy Bitcoin, it was just so obvious. This time around, I think there is a sense of optimism, but given all the new products that are laced into Bitcoin, it becomes a little more complicated to really figure out if it's just as simple as supply and demand, and is that demand retail, or are there, larger exchanges and whales and funds that are, playing with it. And, that's what makes it a little bit harder to understand. Are there scammers that accumulated hundreds of thousands of Bitcoin that are going to sell it at 10,000? Like, how do you predict that? There's a lot more kind of its own kind of black swan events that are really hard to price in, to understand. But even with those, hard to track events, I think, the net, it's going to be net positive in terms of the price long term.
Sure.
I thought it was interesting that the run up last time was after the halving event. So I think, a lot of people are optimistic that with the global economic crisis, the halving event, and consumers waking up to not all money is created equal, I think we're definitely going to see a lot of adoption. And I'm definitely betting on adoption and assuming that that's going to translate into price increase.
Yeah. It's definitely be interesting to see. And we've seen a little bit of a run up just in the last week and a half, or call it 2 weeks now. It's gone up basically $2,000 since then. So lots of interesting things to come. I think the hype, there's definitely a lot of hype towards it too, right? Like everywhere you go is talking about it. I was talking about it with someone a few days ago, and we were saying like how, if this is how it is for this one, like the next one in what, 2024, you know, it's probably going to be on every single news show, right? Like, hey, like the Bitcoin halving is happening. Because I feel like they haven't really been talking about it as much in like the public. I've seen a couple segments on it, but it's not like, it's not mainstream yet, right? Which is kind of a showing of where we're at too, right? We're still early, super early.
For sure. And we also have to ensure that there's not like burnout. You know, it's like, oh, I've heard that story before. But at the same time, I mean, you know, you look at your news feed, it's all Corona, you know, I mean, it's hard to be anything. I mean, if you want to get away with something crazy, now's a good time, because it might be a headline for a day and then, you know, people are going to move on, you know, because of Corona's just dominating the headlines. So it's an interesting media environment. But, you know, once Bitcoin hits like price triggers, like 10,000, it's an easy headline. So we'll start seeing that, and that could continue to accelerate. And then once it hits 15, and then if it breaks the all-time high, 20, you know, that's when it's like taken off. And then people start saying, oh, well, is it too late to buy? And then you got to come up with the arguments for why it's still early.
Yeah. Yeah. So who said that? Someone was saying that, like, basically if, you know, basically the people that get in now are still, you know, so early that, like, you know, they likely won't even impact like what happens with Bitcoin long term. You know what I mean? Like,
totally.
It's like, that's how early it is, which is
I mean, I grew up in Seattle, right? Like, I've been here for a while, and so I saw Amazon grow, and I remember when I first got started in commercial real estate doing brokerage, and you know, guys in the office had done Amazon deals since they were 50,000 square feet. And yeah, that's a phenomenal client to have if you're a real estate agent, and did every deal. And it was just like, I remember they moved into this 450,000 square foot building. And it was like, yeah, like, this is big enough. This is it. You know, we'll start on the bottom floor and eventually grow into it. And within a few years, they were like moving into a building twice as big. And then in a few years, twice as big. And it's just like, geez Louise, are you kidding me? Like, I cannot believe. And now 30% of the office space in Seattle is occupied by Amazon. It's just like, oh my, this is insane. And it's same thing with like their stock. I remember wanting to buy their stock back in 2015 and thinking it was too high. You know, it was just, that was stupid. It definitely wasn't, considering what's happened since then. So
totally
kind of similar with Bitcoin. It's still early, you know, people are still, you know, gaining adoption and getting access to it. You know, the infrastructure is still being laid. You know, those Bitcoin advisors, right, are still reaching out and introducing people to this as an asset class. And as that happens, more demand will come in. At the same time, supply is coming down. So, you know, from just a simple economic perspective, it's highly promising.
Yeah, totally. And which, by the way, this is not financial advice. We're just talking about this, but
just talking.
But that's great, man. So, you know, one thing I want to talk to you about is you got some interesting news. I'd love if you could share that.
Yeah, we just closed our Series A. So,
yeah,
thankfully, thank you. It's interesting times to be closing a Series A. I'll say that. But you know, been working on this for over a year now, and it's been a grind, to say the least. But you know, during that period of time, you know, you got to go through fire before you can become steel, right? You know, just you got to get a lot of no's, you know, to be able to really kind of hone in who you are and as a business. And you know, we learned a lot through that journey, but we're really fortunate to have Pantera Capital come in here and really consume our $10 million Series A. So now I'm thankful to be able to have cash in the bank and be able to focus on growth and, you know, building versus just focused on, you know, selling the vision and the product to investors, which, you know, has its bright spots, but, you know, customers don't know or care. So now I can really get back to focusing on the customer and our products and expanding.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. Congrats on that. And Pantera is like, they're obviously very well regarded, in the space. And so that's a great partner to have.
Yeah. They're awesome. You know, frankly, I have been pleasantly surprised. You know, they're very founder friendly. They get the vision. You know, you don't need to convince them of really anything blockchain or crypto related. They just get it, you know, whereas when you talk to a lot of traditional VCs, you know, you're doing like, if you're doing blockchain 101, you know, you should just move on. But right. you know, they get it. And so if your story and vision and traction, most importantly, you know, is compelling, you know, they'll be there. They'll perk up, they'll jump in, and they'll support you, and they'll open up every resource they have to help build your business. And so it's been awesome working with them so far, and I couldn't recommend them enough. If you're a crypto startup, blockchain company, you know, looking for a venture partner, you know, happy to make an intro if you don't already have an in. But no, they've been awesome. But just real, they've also been one of the largest institutional owner of cryptocurrencies, in addition to being the first US-based Bitcoin venture fund. So having that diversified portfolio is really interesting in terms of how they look at kind of the macro environment, because mm-hmm. for them, they can buy tokens, they could buy crypto, they could buy equity. And so when you think about like their investment thesis, they look at all three mm-hmm. and they kind of, you know, reposition their allocation to those different classes based on the market and what's going on. So, you know, if you get a chance, try to get some of their content or newsletters, but it's really fascinating. Yeah. Whereas if you have a VC fund, it's like, all right, you can only buy equity. So let's talk about what we can do within that. Whereas from their perspective, they can do a lot of things across the ecosystem.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely forward looking. That's great, man. Yeah. Congrats on that. I guess one last thing, just going back to the Coinstar thing is, you know, Coinstar is your partner, but you know, when I think about your product, I think about it very much like being good for Main Street, right? Like, because kind of like you said, is like people go to the grocery store, they buy it there. I don't necessarily think of it like as like a Wall Street, you know, product per se, at least not at this moment in time. And, you know, I was kind of hoping you could just touch on that overall. Like, you know, when we think about cryptocurrency, or when we think about Bitcoin, and we think about how people are in this entry point, there are these bigger companies or bigger Wall Street type institutions that are thinking about it and even creating, you know, futures or funds or things like that. But, you know, I guess what is the biggest difference between the two, and just kind of like your outlook on that overall?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're on Wall Street, you have to go across or under the Hudson River to Jersey to actually use our product. So literally, you have to get off Wall Street to use our product. But the difference, you know, from a consumer perspective is really around an easy on-ramp. And so being able to transact at a grocery store is like a nice hello, a nice welcome mat, a nice way to introduce them into the world of digital currency. So, you know, that's what we see it as, really an entry point, a billboard, a welcome mat for a safe, familiar transaction experience. So that's key. And then they end up in the wallet. Now they're a digital customer. And so you think about, well, now that they have trust and a digital asset, what can you do with that? And that's really where you think about our roadmap, you know, where we want to focus on. But getting them in the door is the hard part. And that's a very important part as well. You know, a lot of companies build brick and mortar retail, which is insanely expensive, just for that simple reason, to get people in the door. You know, yeah. And then obviously with e-commerce, you're fighting a digital marketing brand game to try to do that. So having the kiosk in the grocery store, connection point, familiarity, Coinstar is a brand they trust. It's a great way to get people in the door. From Coinstar's perspective, they're owned by Apollo, which is about a $250 billion private equity fund. And so, you know, they're the ones that are consenting to digital currency. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was interesting because it might be, you know, I haven't done the analysis, but from what I can tell, they're the largest private equity fund that has essentially allowed one of their portfolio companies to dive into digital currency. And I think we'll see more of that. You know, I think thanks to 2017, you know, it legitimized cryptocurrencies, digital currency as an asset class and as something that there's demand for. And I think we'll see more, you know, billion-dollar plus companies, you know, dipping their toe into crypto one way or the other. And you know, frankly, it's been a good bet for Apollo, and you know, work will get out.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, and we've had Jim on interviewed him before as well. And I think what I've liked the most about your partnership there is that it just made business sense for Coinstar, right? And so it's not like a hype or a gimmick of like, oh, it would be really neat if we have this Bitcoin and we can have like some sort of marketing ploy about there. It's like, it actually makes business sense to them. And, you know, I think, you know, as a product manager, that's how my mind thinks, is like, hey, like, what's the business case here? And how do we productize goods and services or technology, or how do we, in this case, productize currency, being productizing the Bitcoin? And it's, you know, part of the, as you're saying, it's a part of the revenue.
Yeah, you think of like clean energy, right? You know, you early on, you have a lot of people that think about it more from like the conservationist, environmentalist perspective, like why we need clean energy. Once it starts making business sense, the adoption for it just goes through the roof.
Exactly. And,
you know, the reality is we live in a capitalistic society, you know, things aren't free. You know, we're not all NGOs with an endless, you know, checkbook. So, yeah. You know, having a business case is really important, you know, in order to accelerate the adoption of a value-based product. You know, I'm very much, you know, you and I are both are very much, we love Bitcoin, you know, for all the reasons of decentralization and being able to provide access to anyone's internet connection, et cetera. But, you know, having a company that's willing to sponsor it, and Jim specifically, you know, I mean, he had to put his neck out, you know, in the early stage of innovation, the risk is high and the promise of return is low. And so it takes a sponsor. And so, you know, Jim was uniquely positioned as the CEO to be able to sponsor it. And he did it. He put his neck out for it and he was patient with it. And, you know, he kept watering the seed and nourishing it and giving it light. And, you know, it's starting to grow into this, you know, plant that will produce some fruit for his business. But it takes time. So, I mean, if there's, you know, larger companies, you know, that are thinking about jumping into digital currency somewhere or the other, you know, just as with any innovative project, you know, be ready to invest and be patient and nourish. And, you know, if something scares you, don't call it a reason to, you know, kill it. And just keep going. Innovation is not easy, but definitely benefits the brave.
You're so right. It's exactly it. A lot of times, you know, a lot of times you see these really big companies have these big innovation groups of like 50 to, you know, hundreds of people that are working on innovation overall. And then maybe some medium size, it's like, there's a sponsor, like there's just one person that's kind of thinking through that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm with you. I think every single organization should have at least one person that part of their job requirement, doesn't have to be their whole job requirement, but part of their job requirement is to be versed and understand the space and start thinking about like what Bitcoin, crypto, digital currency, in-network currency, stablecoin, all kind of all those things, like what would that do to their business? Like, what does that mean overall? Because, mm-hmm. you know, if you don't have someone that's thinking about that for your business, you know, chances are your competition does or is, or, and you're mm-hmm. just, and we've already seen that this isn't going anywhere. So definitely be paying attention to that, or find someone, or like bring someone in, bring someone. I'll come in and I'll help you figure it out.
There you go. Hire Jonathan. He'll be your sponsor.
No,
think big, start small, learn fast, right? Like have a vision for how this can disrupt the world in a positive way, but you know, start small, like run an experiment, see if some of your assumptions are validated, and then, you know, iterate. And totally. You know, obviously that's the model for corporate innovation. And so I think we'll see, you know, definitely if you were like a trend show, right? If you have your top five trends of the year, I think enterprise adoption will be coming and in an accelerated fashion, especially when some companies are gonna struggle, you know, in this new reality that we live in. There's winners and losers. And, you know, oftentimes you see some of the greatest innovation happen in challenging environments like this. And I think it's going to be really exciting to see where that innovation comes from. You know, things that we haven't thought of yet, you know, use cases, applications that we haven't thought of, partners we haven't thought of, you know, it's now. And actually, you know, if you look at like the Small Business Administration, their data around like net new jobs and entrepreneurship, you know, entrepreneurship flourishes in times of a recession. Because mm-hmm. people are either they lose their job and they have an option. Well, now's that time to start that company we've been talking about, you know, but it also forces people to be resourceful.
Yeah.
And that's a really key thing for innovation and starting a new company.
Definitely. Awesome. Well, Neil, I've enjoyed this conversation. You're probably familiar with this, but my last question is the same question I ask everybody. And that is, what's a question that you have that you would like to ask the audience so they can think about as they go about their day? What's a question you want to leave people with?
Yeah, maybe if there's one person that you could call and to have a 15-minute conversation with them about why they should buy Bitcoin, who is that?
I like it. I like that. It's Mother's Day. Maybe think about your mom coming up.
Hey, mom, gift Bitcoin. Maybe don't convince her to buy it on her big day. But,
Exactly. Gift it to her. Yeah. Awesome. Well, Neil, what are some good ways that people can follow you or stay in contact with you overall?
Yeah, I mean, feel free to go to coinme.com if you're, we're hiring. So if you're interested, you know, feel free to check out the website. Love to take a look. You know, that's a great way to stay connected. Follow us on Twitter and LinkedIn, are great places as well. So yeah, stay in touch and sign up for the newsletter and we'll keep you apprised of what's coming next.
Awesome. Awesome. Neil, thanks again. Hopefully we'll see each other, soon in person.
Yes. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. Everybody, thank you for listening to another episode of the TF Podcast. Please make sure that you are subscribed wherever you listen to podcasts. Do us a favor and fill in those stars. It goes a long way if you enjoy it. And please share. Please let other people know about this podcast that we're doing share some Bitcoin with them, as Neil mentioned. Please follow me on Twitter at JG Product and us at TF Blockchain. And always feel free to reach out and happy to help where we can. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see y'all soon.